Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Christmas is such an exciting time of the year. Even though it's filled with all kinds of commercialism, it is an opportunity for us to talk about the reason for the season. Tonight on the White Horse Inn, we're talking about this very topic, defending Christ, with our special guest, Dr. Al Mohler. For those of you who don't know Dr. Mohler, he's a man widely acclaimed by Time Magazine, Christianity Today, as a strategic leader, not only among Southern Baptists, but as a frequent guest on Larry King Live and in the wider culture. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and host of Truth Online. Another special guest joining us is Dr. Mark Dever, senior pastor of Capitol Hill Baptist Church in Washington, D.C. I'm Mike Horton, professor of historical theology at Westminster Seminary in California and president of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. And here with me is one of our regular hosts and cohorts, Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, professor of apologetics at Concordia University in Irvine, California. Gentlemen, what is the starting point for apologetics today? Because the assumption is we're living in a phenomenally different age than has ever existed in the history of mankind. And therefore, that which may have worked even 20 or 30 years ago can't work now. We have to have completely different approaches to winning people to Christ and Christian nurture and apologetics, so forth. First of all, how do we respond to the challenge that everything has changed?
First of all, I think we should challenge that. Much as it has changed, but the idea that we have a species, sui generis, that's never appeared on the face of the earth and has no idea of truth whatever left in him, even though he is fallen, I think we should challenge.
I think if we assume that we know nothing about Christianity for a moment and just think of man, the symbol maker, man that has humanity, that has the same ongoing nature, you can see that in every age there has been a worldview that has been characteristic of that age. And certainly with our more global perspective now, we know there can be different worldviews representing different persons in different places. But human nature is the constant. The basic need of human life is the constant. The issue of truth is a constant in every single culture and in every single worldview. And so if we don't even know anything about Christianity, we know that much about the human reality is a constant. And then we recognize from a gospel perspective that the truth of the eternal God has not changed. The most basic fundamental need of human beings has not changed, and the inherent content of the gospel has not changed.
Some people say that today we don't think linearly anymore. We think in mosaics. You know, they talk about postmodernism and an experience of young people not being able to relate to any kind of if-then logical thinking. Well, that's just not true. Yeah. You know, I know that I'm sure video may have some impact on our attention spans or on the way we learn things, but we are able to understand if-then statements. We are able to reason. Yeah, I've seen young men and women at Georgetown University in D.C. come to Christ reading evidentialist defenses of the resurrection. Now, I know it's the Holy Spirit working in their heart.
Right.
I know that book didn't do it, but it's just not true to say that people can't reason anymore.
Yeah, well, you think about something as fundamental as being on a cruise ship, and there's a briefing about how one ought to get to a lifeboat in order to be rescued under the circumstance. You have clear propositional truth claims, and a logical progression, and people understand that. No one wants a postmodernist surgeon or a postmodernist pilot. You know, what it comes down to is it really is about lifestyle issues where postmodernism comes in. It's really where it threatens to get in our personal space and tell us we're a sinner and tells us there's an objective right and wrong. So when you think about all this conversation about postmodernity, a lot of it just has to be written off to persons wanting to do what they want to do and not to be confronted with it. I think you've asked a very important question when you began. How is the apologetic challenge really changed? And I've been writing and thinking about this lately, and it strikes me that I guess in some case, in some surreal sense, we can be envious of the 20th century, where there were real meat and potatoes atheists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had people like Bertrand Russell and Anthony Flew and A.J. Ayer and others. And
made arguments.
Their point? Oh, they made arguments. They said there is no God. They said
that
any proposition that carries that word in it has no cognitive meaning. No. It's incapable of being true or false.
Right. And even that, of course, fell in on itself in terms of epistemology. But basically, you had these people saying, listen, I'm bold to claim atheism as my worldview.
It is right.
That's right. In a lot of ways, that is much preferable to what we have today, yes, which is kind of the Oprahification of America, in which everything comes down to if it works for you, it's great.
Yes.
And Christianity is not a gospel that offers itself as this may work for you, you ought to try it.
Mm-hmm. Quite the opposite in the New Testament. If you want your life to get worse, become a Christian.
Yeah, come and die.
That's where your illustration, Al, about the lifeboat was so good, you know, or a pilot. I mean, those are illustrations that anybody will intuitively understand. Another thing is you just go to their personal life and start asking why. I mean, you'll get to those lifestyle questions pretty quickly if they start answering them honestly. Really, why don't you think that's the case? Or why is that? Or why does that bother you? Why are you scared of death?
It seems that at the heart of this challenge, apologetic challenge, is the whole matter of religious pluralism. I don't think, you know, all of us sitting around this table are proponents, or in fact, delighted that modernity has brought about greater tolerance on a whole variety of fronts. In fact, Baptists played a large role. But religious pluralism is sort of swept in with all the other kinds of forms of pluralism and tolerance. To say that not only are all people equal before the law, but all ideas are equal, all religions are equal. There cannot be one way of being saved, because that would mean some people are wrong and some people are actually destined for eternal punishment.
That's where Christianity is most politically offensive in the light of the postmodern worldview, because the whole issue comes down to the word one. Postmodernity is based upon the reality that there is no one anything. Mm-hmm. There's no one truth. There's no one meta-narrative, the word they use for a grand explanatory principle. There's no one truth. There's no one savior. There's no one human need, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And the gospel comes back and says there is only one God, and salvation comes through the one mediator, his son, Jesus Christ. But, you know, one thing we need to go back and remember is that the heart of biblical faith starts out with monotheism. It comes back to that. And I was speaking to someone just recently in the media who said to me, you know, when do Christians come up with this idea of exclusivity? And I said, well, we got it where it started with God speaking to the children of Israel. And first, let's remind ourselves in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 39, the Lord said, know therefore today and take it to your heart that the Lord, he is God in heaven above and on the earth below. There is no other. Mm-hmm. And so Christianity came and said, we know that one God through his one son, Jesus Christ, the one mediator between God and man. And Christians didn't come up with exclusivity as the best platform for a missionary endeavor. Rather to the contrary, it's the understanding of that central claim that is absolutely non-negotiable.
And there's Paul at Mars Hill saying as testimony against them. And then he it leads him to the conclusion, not that, well, we all see things, we call this God by different names, but it leads him rather to say, now you don't have any excuse, because this God whom you do not know has been revealed in the person of Jesus Christ, and God has proved that he is going to judge all people
raising him from the dead. Paul says something there that is so offensive. In Acts chapter 17, he speaks to the Athenians and acknowledges their religiosity and the prevailing polytheism led to so many different gods. Every god had a temple, and even the temple to a god whose name they didn't know.
They're too religious.
Yes, absolutely. and along comes Paul, and these are the words that are so offensive. He says, you ought not to think that God desires to be served with human hands and inhabits a temple made with human hands. Mm. You know, that is the real offensiveness now, when we have to say to persons, you ought not to think that. Mm. Your beliefs are false.
You know, the Human Rights Campaign has done a great job of trying to show that their gay rights agenda is completely acceptable intuitively, because they've adopted the rainbow, you know, these multicolors. Mm-hmm. And the subtle message of that visually is that they're all just different colors.
Who says you ought not to think like X, Y, or Z more than the gay movement? You ought not to think like someone who disapproves homosexuality.
That's true. That's an inherent contradiction. But I think that what they've done, what their advertising, you know, firm has done that came up with that, is a brilliant move tactically. I mean, you have to agree with that. But that's been applied to everything. And so we've cultivated the idea that differences are fundamentally meaningless and they're good in and of themselves.
Let's give the devil his
just
due.
Religion just gets lumped into that.
Now, let's give the devil his due. I think of Herbert Marcuse, the philosopher the hippies all loved because of his views on sex. One of his basic ideas that is neglected is that every idea is basically totalitarian. Mm-hmm. In other words, every idea that demands to be taken seriously and demands to be recognized as true is a totalitarian idea. It says this is true and that which is not this is not true.
Yeah.
And again, that is the way we live in everyday life.
I try to get across to my students that if they give up a concept of truth, if they give up classical epistemology, the next thing you see is power. Political power comes out of the barrel of a gun, and it doesn't take long to get there.
Yeah. Al, you many times have appeared on the Larry King Show to talk about some of these issues. How have you found that the message of Christ is, and you've done it so winsomely, but you have stood squarely for the exclusivity of Christ. It's good news, not bad news. There is a way of salvation. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any way of salvation. And how has that message been received out there in America when you run into people who've seen you on the programs?
I'll have to say that I believe that is now the most volatile issue. That's the flashpoint. And persons have been acculturated in America to believe that right-thinking persons don't think that way. And they also
it's
see—
It's pathological?
Well, it's pathological, and it's also anti-progressive. There's this impulse that America is becoming more and more sophisticated, and so we're learning how to live with each other to a greater degree of affability. And so one of the things we've learned is not to make truth claims like that. And it's just so difficult to speak to persons who think already that no right-minded person would think in any such way. And it really isn't a matter of logic. They are not, they're not pluralists because they've come to a principled, logical understanding of this. It's just what is fed to them in the media. And, you know, one of the issues in the media and talking about such a thing is the syndrome that Neil Postman talks about, where you talk about the most profound truth that human beings can possibly know, and the next thing you know, you have a segue and say, and now this, and you're in a laxative commercial.
Yeah, right.
And so the media doesn't help by trivializing everything, but it is the Mars Hill, to go back to Act 17. Mm-hmm. It's where these issues are debated. Mm-hmm. And so we have to understand that I think that we don't win great victories in the media. We try to get a toehold to declare the truth and hope that the Spirit of God will sovereignly use that in some way. And it is important, I think, we realize that Christian truth claims should be asserted in the public square. And popularity cannot be our concern. But I appreciate what you said. We do, we must strive to be winsome without compromising. Because the one thing, again, that in this offensive, conscious age where everyone's ready to take offense, we have to make sure the offense is the gospel and not the gospel speaker, the gospel teller. Mm.
Of course, all of us deal in the realm of regular local church ministry as well as in our other vocations. But especially you, Mark, you are pastor of a church in the inner city on Capitol Hill. You run into a lot of people who probably associate your brand of Christianity with Muslim extremism or right-wing republicanism. How can we preach Christ today and not be thought of in cultural terms as these wackos out there on the edge culturally? How can the claim that Christ is the way, the truth, and the life be seen apart from those images? Or
that's a great question. There's no way you can assure that'll be the case. How can we so that they will not? Well, we can't do that. Now, are there things we can do that don't give them unnecessary brickbats they can throw at us? Yeah, I think we can try to preach biblically. We cannot be scared of biblical truth. We can try to preach winsomely. You know, but how do you preach winsomely to somebody about their sin?
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I think you can do that. You see Christ doing that with a woman at the well in John 4. And we can have a community.
But even to do what Jesus did with her at the well in John 4, today would be considered just in principle in incredibly bad taste.
Think of the judgmentalism writ large throughout that entire passage.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that Mark does in his ministry that we ought to mention here, we all ought to do is realize when we speak about sin, we're speaking as sinners to fellow sinners.
Yes.
And I think that's where...
And sometimes we don't do that.
No, Christians sometimes sound as if we're pontificating about that which we once knew.
Somebody asked C.S. Lewis one time, how in the world do you get across the concept of sin in modern England? And he answered, I usually talk about my own last 24 hours.
That's great.
It's a great answer.
Yeah.
Within the Christian community, Luther used to say that this is a good place to learn to practice sola scriptura. That is, if you are going to look inside yourself to find some sort of assurance from down deep inside the self, he believed that you look deep down inside the self and found all sorts of mess and sin instead. So with regard to sanctification, you learn, he said, to believe in it because the text promises it and not because you see your progress in it.
And there's something else here. The postmodern worldview, like every worldview, in terms of its missiological opportunity and its openness to the gospel, comes with pluses and minuses. I think the emphasis upon community in postmodernism is a very helpful thing. Because if I understand the New Testament aright, the world ought to look not so much at Christians, but at the church and see an alternative way of living, an alternative way of believing that becomes very, very attractive, even as at first it may be repulsive. And I go back to one of the earliest of the regional administrators writing to Trajan, the Roman emperor, said, these people are odd. They don't commit adultery. They do not divorce. We don't quite get it yet, but they're up to something, we're sure, and that something may not be good. You know, we're gonna get to the bottom of this because the very way they live stands out and requires some explanation. Now, we can't say that that means we simply live that way and the job is done. The truth-telling part is non-negotiable, but the truth-telling divorced from the living it out is, I think, something that postmodernism says we won't hear.
And not just living it out individually, an individual virtue like a good Mormon. But I mean, living it out in a whole community, living it out, a context of people with all those many relationships. Don Carson's book, Telling the Truth, that he edited, D.A. Carson, Zondervan published it, just came out in paperback, Telling the Truth, good collection of essays on evangelism in a postmodern age. And I did the one in there on communicating a sense of sin in postmodern world.
Great.
So where I talk about that particularly, and there are other essays in there that I think if you're listening, you might find helpful on this.
Just as we affirm tolerance and equality of all people before the law, and Christians have historically given their greatest support to that kind of public human rights perspective, and yet have held very intolerant views about different ways of salvation, for instance. How can you explain to a person that Jesus Christ is the only way, truth, and life, and yet not sound exclusive of that person or exclusive of people who don't hold that view? How do you distinguish between Christ is the only way and people who don't believe in Christ as somehow excluded from your circle of friends or excluded from
humanity?
Right. Well, one of the things we have to admit is that the heart of the gospel from our part is humility. And the understanding that we are not redeemed and we do not know Christ because we are morally superior to other persons, more intelligent or even spiritually sensitive than other persons. We've been saved by grace. And as sinners saved by grace, we seek to take that gospel to others so that they may experience the same thing on the same ground through the same Savior. You know, one of the things we can do winsomely, I think, is to help persons come to a point of honesty about their own worldview and most basic convictions, because in the busyness and consumer-mindedness and entertainment-focused nature of American culture, reflection is just largely absent. Most persons have no idea, and they take no time to think about what they really believe. And we can help them with that by understanding that if Christianity sounds odd at first hearing, that's probably a good thing. And if it was just the conventional wisdom, there would have been no need for the incarnation.
Yeah.
The gospel is a counter-revolutionary, counterintuitive message.
Right.
When I speak to people evangelistically, I say, listen, I know if this sounds odd to you, it should. This is not what you would think on your own any more than I thought of this on my own.
You ask people on the street, who do you think, do you believe in heaven or hell? And if they say, yeah, I believe in heaven and hell. Who goes to heaven? Who goes to hell? Well, good people go to heaven. Really bad people go to hell. That's intuitive. It's right. Counterintuitive to tell people God justifies the wicked. That's right. About the most
Absolutely.
Counterintuitive thing you can tell people.
And most persons really do have, if they really are honest with themselves, they really have enough self-knowledge to know that they have a problem they cannot solve. They may not have a vocabulary that would use words like sin and condemnation and guilt, but they do know they have a problem they cannot solve. And we can speak to that need, as the Apostle Paul did. You know, there's another important point here, and that is that people genuinely these days, probably all throughout human history, but in our consumer-focused kind of prepackaged environment we live in, we want to know the whole thing before we buy in. And that's one of the problems, I think, with contemporary evangelism. There is no way any of us will know the whole thing by the time we die.
Right.
And so one of the things the church can say winsomely is, listen, on the authority of God's own word, as he has spoken to us, we know this much. And we've come thus far. And we are together trying to live this out under the authority of the word by...
Well, I was going to say earlier, I think, again, there's a connection that one of the two brought up. Harry Blamires, who probably is as close to Lewis as anyone after Lewis's death, used to say that in the 50s, sometimes the only way contemporary people can hear the law is death. Mm-hmm. I make jokes that we don't allow death in Irvine, California. It's part of the CC&Rs that we don't have that there. And some catch the irony of it. I don't think we have a cemetery in that city. Mm-hmm. And in one way, Blamires was right. That sometimes the attention to the saving message is going to come through the law / death.
And that didn't just happen in pre-modern times.
No.
Death still happens to post-moderns too.
Yes.
Romans 5.
Some things go on as they always have.
That was Paul's argument. The universality of death points to the universality of sin.
Right.
Well, and isn't it important for people who are listening right now to say, wait, Nietzsche, postmodernism, Derrida, all of these references are very difficult for me. Isn't it important for them to know, hey, you can ask a person, can you live that way?
Mm-hmm.
That's something you can do no matter what level of understanding you have of the culture today. Get people to face their own lives and see themselves for the inconsistency between their thought and their action.
You know, I was reading Chesterton the other day, G.K. Chesterton, who's probably more of a wit than anything else in terms of putting him in a category. But, you know, he really gave a lot of attention to hypocrisy, as did Samuel Johnson. But you know what? These days, it is hard to be a decent hypocrite. Because postmodernism has kind of undercut the worldview whereby you would even try to give a tip of the hat to a worldview that you claim but do not live. And that's where we need to help persons to know that they really are living out inconsistencies. Mm-hmm. They may not see them, and the culture's not there anymore to slap them on the wrist and point it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hypocrisy is the compliment that vice pays to virtue.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but that's no longer being paid anymore because it's no longer seen as virtuous.
Well, and see, our evangelistic task, people used to think, was easier because people knew they were sinners. Why? Because people would tell them they were. Yeah. You know, the media would tell them they were. Their neighbors would tell them. There was agreed upon morality. Well, now, that's gone. And that's where we come. And so far as the lost person may first appear or the watching world, you know, we come wagging the Puritan finger as they stereotype that.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.